fundamental interest is the neuronal basis of behavior, and the behavior I'm interested in is learning in insects, and the neurons I'm interested in are the insect brain and particular regions called the mushroom bodies. And I'm interested in these concepts in a behavioral, in a developmental context, so learning across the lifetime of a hemimetabolous insect. So what I mean by insect learning, insects can learn many different things. A butterfly that visits a yellow flower and receives a rich nectar reward will then begin to visit more yellow flowers. So the foraging behavior of this butterfly has been modified with its experience. This Polistes wasp has learned to associate odor cues coming off the plate.
And that takes about 12 days for pupation to be complete. And from there, the adult will emerge, and an adult female can lay about 500 eggs during her lifetime, and she can live for 5 to 6 months in the field. The other interesting part about the biology is how it correlates to the crop phenology. So the adults emerge in March or April, approximately, and the interesting thing is that the olives support the larval development beginning in July. And this will go through November if there is a harvest, because that's when the olives are harvested, or through January if there is no harvest and the olives are on the trees. And there are approximately 3 to 5 generations per year. So the one technique, control technique, I did not talk to you about was mating disruption. And this is a technique where you saturate the area with sex pheromone to interfere with the mate finding. And this is a technique that is commonly used in moths, where the female puts out the pheromone and the male is the one trying to locate the female. And this is exactly what happens in the olive fruit fly. However, the olive fruit fly is actually an exception to in its family, because in the Taphridid family, most species, the male puts out the pheromone and the female is the one who looks for the male. So I was interested in looking at the courtship and mating behaviors to see if there was any way we could work with mating disruption. So what I wanted to look at was the daily schedule in the field and also the courtship and mating behavior in the lab first. So the questions I wanted to answer was when they mate, where do they mate, and if there's any step in the courtship behavior that we can actually disrupt. So the first thing I did was a daily activity experiment. I did it with Hannah Burek. And what we used were McPhail traps. We had one McPhail trap with yeast, it's a food attractant, and one McPhail trap with a pheromone cap. So the trap is what you're seeing right here. So we put one yeast trap and one pheromone trap per tree on 10 different trees that were approximately 18 meters apart. We counted the males and females trapped every hour from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. We did this in Northern California, Oroville. And you can see the results here. In May, we found quite a few male and female flies in the yeast trap, but we found absolutely none in the pheromone trap. And in June, we found a lot more flies in the yeast traps, but still very, very few in the pheromone traps. So that made me think if the pheromone was actually working. So I ran a very small experiment where I put out one McPhail trap with a pheromone capsule, and another one with 25 virgin females. They will be the ones who would be putting out the pheromone. I left it up for 48 hours in Davis, California. And the results were that I found absolutely no flies in the virgin female traps, but I found 31 males and 6 females in the pheromone trap. So the pheromone was actually working. And then I did another experiment. I ran another experiment, but I decided that maybe the McPhail traps were not the best for my purposes. So I tried out different kinds of traps, and I decided that the white sticky traps were the ones that would work best for my purposes. So what I had was a control, one capsule of pheromone, and 24 capsules of pheromone per trap. And I had 10 repetitions of each of these, and I checked the traps weekly. And what I'm going to show you are the results for the males only. So I did this on 5 different dates, and the different letters are significant differences, or significantly different. And the numbers you see are a mean number of males per trap, and the numbers between parentheses are a standard error. So you can see that there are differences among dates. And also, there are differences among treatments. So the control was different from one capsule and it was different from 24 capsules. So from here, what we can conclude is that there seems to be a seasonal response where there is no response of the males to the pheromone in spring, which is actually something that we ended up finding in the literature, but not backed up with data, just stated. We still need to look at the daily schedule because I couldn't figure that out because of the numbers I was trapping originally. So I'm still wondering if they actually do mate only at dusk, which is what the literature says. But again, there's no data to support that. And what I can say is that higher concentrations of pheromone attract more males. Up to now, I've gone to 24 capsules, and I still keep trapping more males instead of confusing them in any way. The other thing I've been looking at was the courtship behavior in the lab. So the mating at dusk is still a question for me, and if they actually do mate only at dusk, what is it that cues them in for that? Is it the light intensity? Is there a temperature change? Or anything else? The courtship behaviors I've been looking at, I've been putting males and females together in a petri dish and basically looking at what they do. And I've seen many different things. The most interesting for me is the female rub. Basically what she does is rub her hind legs on the anal part of her abdomen and then put that perfume all over the rest of her body. So she gets ready for the courtship. The male also does a rub. We don't know what he is doing because he's not the one putting out the sex pheromone. So there is a rub, and I don't know what that is about yet. They also can stay facing each other still for a very long time, over a minute, just doing absolutely nothing, just facing each other. There's chasing, there's wing flicking, and there's wing fanning done by the male. So there's an auditory thing going on there. And the other thing that they do is they butt heads, but I don't know what they're doing yet. So this is in progress. The actual mating behavior, I've been looking at the length of the pre-mating time, how long it takes for them to actually start mating, and also the mating duration in itself. It's about 3 or 4 hours. I'm looking at how many matings there are per female, per male. We want to know if there is a male competition and if it's for the female or for territory of opposition sites maybe. We don't know if there's female competition either. And we don't know the location of the mating, where they actually do it. If it's on the tree, on the bark, on the leaf, and you know, inside the canopy, outside, what height? So those are questions that I would like to answer. The field application of these lab results would be that with the seasonal schedule and the location of matings and the daily mating schedule, we would make the mating disruption technique much more efficient on how we put it out in the field. And that way, it should work much better for us. With that, I've finished my presentation. I would like to thank all the people in my lab and who've been helping me, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
Plenty of time for questions.
Yes?
Why do you think that the virgin females didn't serve to attract any males? Do you have any idea?
Okay, so the question is, why do I think the female virgins did not attract the males? I really do not know. I think in that case, the traps were pretty close together. It was just, you know, a very, very preliminary thing. And they were very close together. So what I think is maybe the pheromone capsule was overwhelming the 25 females. Yes, back there. Jim.
The absence of catches in the spring, is that related to summer conditions not being favorable for olive fly? Or why do you think you didn't catch anything in the spring?
So the question is why I think we didn't catch anything in the spring. And we really don't know. that we thought we were going to catch some, but we don't. So we don't know if it's something that in other places we can find olives all year round. And we can find fruit flies all year round. I don't know if they can actually develop in the very old decaying olives that stay on the trees, but that might be it. That they're doing okay in some other places, and they just got to Davis, California, or Oroville, California, and it doesn't work the same way there for them. But we really don't know. There was one more question.
What age were your virgin flies?
I'm sorry.
What age were your virgin flies?
The age of my virgin flies were 3 to 4 days old, and that's the time it takes for them to mature the ovaries and start.
And then I'm going to talk about the dendrochronological technique that we're using to date the scars in the tree rings of the trees that were attacked. And then I'm going to talk about the temporal patterns that we've seen in these data throughout time and some possible explanations for these patterns. So the red oak borer does have a 2-year life cycle, but I'm going to talk about it in terms of calendar years because that's important for the dating process. And this insect emerges every odd-numbered year, and we don't know why this is. But larvae are only active in the summer and fall. So during their first year, they will females oviposit in bark crevices or under lichen, and larvae immediately attack, chewing into the phloem tissue, which is the inner bark, or the tissue that transports nutrients throughout the tree. And they will create a gallery where they feed in here, and they will overwinter in there. And This is a picture of a first-year larva. And during their second year, they will enlarge this phloem gallery, and then they will chew into the sapwood, or the tissue that transports water throughout the tree. And as they chew into the sapwood, they will cross the cambial layer, which is a layer of differentiating tissue. And this is important because as they cross this layer, this initiates the wound response in trees. And so this is how we're able to date the scars. And so on your left is a picture of an enlarged phloem gallery that's been cleaned out. And on your right is a picture of a sapwood tunnel and a second-year larva. So then the next summer, they will emerge as adults in an odd-numbered year. And this is a picture of an adult getting ready to emerge. So this is a native insect that's usually present at really low densities, one or two insects per tree, and it really doesn't cause a lot of damage unless there's an outbreak. And there have been no previously documented outbreaks in the literature until this recent outbreak in Arkansas oak forests. And we first noticed a dieback in 1999 in the Ozark and Ouachita Mountains. But this is also associated with oak decline, so there are other factors to consider, such as drought, aging forests, poor site conditions, poor soils, and root rot fungi and defoliating insects as well. But we have noticed recently that the outbreak seems to be over. So why did it occur in the first place, and why is it over now? In order to answer this question, we have to know exactly when it happened. So this is our sampling scheme, and we took sections of red oak tree trunks at every half meter from the base of the tree to the greatest height of insect infestation, and these sections were about 5 centimeters thick. We had 4 research sites, and we took 5 trees from each site, and this resulted in about 500 cross sections, and the mean DVH of these trees was 30 centimeters. And this is a picture of the top of a cross section, and you can see you can see the tunnels from the second year larvae, and around the edge are the scars as the insects burrow from the phloem tissue into the xylem tissue. And these scars are right around the edge because the outbreak occurred in the last 10 years or so. So these are our research sites. We had 3 in the Ozark National Forest and 1 in the Ouachita National Forest. And these are the data that we created from scars. And they both have the same axes, these graphs do. On the x-axis is year, and on the y-axis is mean number of scars per cross-section. And this top graph represents the Ozark National Forest, and the outbreak occurred there from 1996 until 2004, and the outbreak in the Ouachitas occurred 4 years earlier, from 1992 until 2002. And also, prior to the outbreak, there's a greater population of insects via scars prior to the outbreak, and we barely see a population at all in the Ozarks prior to the outbreak. So why did we see differences in the timing of the outbreak? Well, climate's a possibility. Drought is often important in other forest insect outbreaks. Drought could be important in this outbreak, but can it be generalized across these 2 forests? This is a picture on the top of the Ozarks, and this is the Ouachitas down here, and they're very different topographically, so perhaps microsite conditions are important when evaluating drought. Also, stand dynamics, tree age. As trees age, they may decline in physiological function, and they may not be able to resist insect attack, and maybe growth will be a good indicator of this. And I also wanted to point out the difference in topography between these 2 areas. The Ozarks have a lot of rolling hills with east, west, and north and south facing aspects, but the Ouachitas on the bottom here have these long pointy ridges going east-west but having north and south facing aspects. And we already know that topography is important for these insects. They seem to be more successful on south facing slopes or ridges or drier areas, and so these differences in topography between these 2 areas may be influencing difference in the outbreak. So this is the same graph we saw before of the Ouachita Mountain sites. And this graph below is the Palmer Drought Severity Index. And they're lined up so that the year is the same on both of them. And the Palmer Drought Severity Index is a measure of moisture availability for tree growth. And so everything below the 0 line represents moisture deficit, and everything above it represents a surplus or good growing conditions. So prior to the outbreak, severe drought periods seem to be related to increases in numbers of scars or increases in numbers of insects. But in the decade prior to the outbreak, we don't see a very severe drought period that lasts for a long time. So it's hard to tell whether drought has is associated with this outbreak, although we know that this insect is more successful on drier aspects and trees growing on those aspects. So it is possible that it's important. Also, the Palmer Drought Severity Index is very regional data. The one region where these data was calculated contains all four of our study sites, and so we may need to look at local data of temperature, moisture, or even soil moisture. So what about tree age? This is a graph of our four sites, and this is the Ouachita site, and these are the three Ozark sites here on the x-axis. And on the y-axis is tree age. And on average, the Ouachita National Forest trees are at least 5 years older than the Ozark trees. So if red oak borer can only attack trees of a certain age because they can't defend themselves anymore, then this makes sense because the outbreak occurred earlier in the Ouachitas. So what about tree growth? These data are from the same trees that we collected scar data from. And this is year on the x-axis again, and on the y-axis is mean ring width. And there is a decline in growth during the last couple decades, but is this associated with red oak borer? Well, it seems to be. The increase in red oak borer numbers happens at about the same time that the decline in growth happens. But there are other factors going on, such as there were several drought periods in here. These could be successively weakening trees, causing this decline in growth. These trees are aging. That may also be causing the decline in growth, or it may be just the presence of red oak borer infesting them. So in conclusion, we saw a difference in the timing of the outbreak. It occurred earlier in the Ouachita Mountains and later in the Ozark Mountains. Also, drought is likely involved, but we can't tell exactly how important it is in the recent outbreak. And tree age is likely important because older trees were infested earlier. And we saw these trends in declining radial growth that happened at the same time as the outbreak. And in order to tell if red oak borer infestation is causing this decline in growth, we'll need to sample more areas on several other aspects. So I'd like to thank everyone in my lab and on my committee and the USDA Forest Service for supporting us, as well as the Arkansas Agricultural Experimental Station. And I'd like to thank you for your attention, and I'd be glad to take any questions.
Or add different elements to the structure of your community, as well as factors like immigration or emigration. For my research, what I focused on was the effects of predation of insect predators and how those varied in space. So there is a fairly significant body of literature that suggests that bird predators may have a significant impact on insect and spider communities, particularly in temperate regions. And for herbivores, there's even evidence that effects cascade down so that plant communities in turn are affected. So my first theme is predation. The second is vertical space. And when you think of a forest, you can divide it up into different elements of vertical or different strata.